It is 2:06 on Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We are here to talk about local, state, national politics today, as we usually do. And of course, these days, it's hard to start a show without saying, boy, we have a lot to talk about, and we do. Greg Bluestein, a political reporter for the AJC, is here. Hi, Greg. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Wearing a suit because you're down at the Capitol.
Yeah, I got the tie, the blue, the gray.
Yeah, yeah. As is your colleague, Kyle Wingfield, columnist for the AJC. We read your column on Thursdays and Sundays in the paper.
That's right,
and
yeah.
You're dressed up pretty nice. You're,
I got to fulfill the uniform requirement down there.
Kyle, as many of you know, writes from a conservative viewpoint in the AJC 2 days a week. And back with us, we haven't seen you in a while, Beth Shapiro, retired pollster, political consultant. It's really nice to have you back and here to talk about politics.
I'm glad to be here and glad I don't have to wear the uniform anymore.
Yeah, me neither. Me neither. Before we actually get into our conversation, a couple of notes. First of all, we always want you to join us by tweeting us at PoliticsGPB. We love to hear what you're thinking as the conversation goes on. And then just a note about the other show that our team, our Political Rewind team, produces here, Two Way Street, which many of you know airs on Saturday and Sunday. We're going to be doing a show in front of a live audience Friday night at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library. And we really would love, you know, it's free of charge, you don't need a reservation, but we're talking to an Emory University professor, Benjamin Reese, about a really interesting book he's written called Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. And he tells great stories about how industrialization, about how new rules about what's appropriate and not appropriate for how we sleep have in fact turned us into a nation, if not insomniacs, of people who are troubled sleepers. So we'd love to have you join us at the Carter Presidential Library. We start at 7 o'clock Friday night. And if you can be there, be great. We love saying hello to our listeners whenever we have a chance to. Okay, let's talk politics. Greg, let me start with you, because you had a pretty long takeout in the paper about the beginning of the Georgia governor's race in 2018. Nathan Deal will be at the end of his second term, has to step down. We're going to have an open seat election for the first time in 8 years. Talk to us a little bit.
Yeah, and this election wasn't really supposed to formally launch until after the legislative session ends in a few weeks. But we got word earlier this week that Secretary of State Brian Kemp is definitely in the running, although he hasn't formally announced yet. He called lawmakers and let others know that he was running. We also have Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle on the Republican side, who's all but guaranteed to get in. And on the Democratic side, you have House Minority Leader Stacey Abrams. But beyond that, there's a lot of questions. House Speaker Ralston on the Republican side is thinking about it. Several state senators, including Michael Williams and Josh McCoon, are both thinking about it. You have any number of outsider businessmen. There's a few more rumors just today about what outsider businessmen on the Republican side could get in. And you've got Sally Yates and Jason Carter still out there on the Democratic side who might end up running for office.
Yeah, Kyle, the question becomes, does jumping in really early really have an impact in a positive way? I mean, in 2010, that last open race, the guy who jumped in very quickly first was John Oxendine, and former insurance commissioner, and that didn't prove to be a particularly helpful move for him. His campaign went up in flames.
Yeah, I'm not sure timing was his biggest problem.
Yeah, well, that's
in
true.
That election. Not to suggest that that's what you were implying, but I do wonder, and I had some people ask me after Greg reported about Secretary Kemp getting in. Why did he go ahead and do that? What advantage does he get? I'm not sure there really is one. I think, the thinking has been get finished with a session, and then everything would kind of unfold from there. So it is interesting to see kind of somebody try to get kind of a first move advantage, that kind of thing. Beyond the normal stuff of getting a team in place, starting to talk to donors, but you can do that without announcing,
right?
I'm not sure what comes of getting out there early, And to be fair, I guess, to Secretary Kemp, he didn't stand up and make an announcement. You know, this was reported. So he hasn't done anything formally at this point. But I think once we get to, when we get to the end of April, we're going to have a pretty full field at that point, and then we'll hit the ground running from there.
Well, I think in addition to the reasons that Kyle cited for getting in early, another one is to perhaps ward off competition. So there may be a potential candidate for governor that Kemp looks at as a
yeah, kind of the way it worked in the Republican presidential primary contest.
yeah, how did that work out?
No one seems to be afraid of competition these days.
Look at the sixth district, the
era of the big field is upon us here. So.
And I was going to say too, the sixth district has scrambled some of the announcement plans too. I mean, we'll find out, but because that's April 18th and there's so much national and local attention, and that's basically the Republican, I guess, breadbasket of the state as well in terms of fundraising, that in the 5th District, that I think that might delay some actual formal announcement plans, too, until after April 18th.
Well, I've heard the reverse as well, which is that if you want to get some attention while a lot of extra reporters are in town, you know, you might have some extra cameras that would show up to an announcement. So yeah. We'll have to see which way they play it. But, everybody's got their own strategy at this point.
Beth, let's talk. I want to talk about Republican potential contenders in a minute, but let's talk about Democrats for a second here. As Greg points out, Stacey Abrams, it's pretty well assumed that the minority leader in the House is going to jump into this race. You know, Jason Carter perhaps comes back and tries again. I think the big question is, how much do the dynamics of the state have to change in the next 2 years to make it viable for a Democrat to win the governor's mansion? You know, the Democrats tried to make the case last time around that this was their year with Michelle Nunn and Jason Carter, and of course it didn't work out that way. But with Trump as a wild card, does that potentially make the field more amenable to a Democrat, do you think?
I think that we still have to have a harmonic convergence for a Democrat to win, even in 2018. And as a Democrat, it pains me to have to admit that, but I think that's true. But I also think, and this is where the 6th district race to me is very interesting, that there is an enormous amount of energy, I think on both sides, but I feel it much more on the Democratic side, around that race. There are several Democrats in there. Certainly a lot of money and leadership have coalesced around one particular Democrat. But I see things happening that I only see happening in presidential years. A couple of examples. One is a friend of mine, a woman in her 50s, active Democrat, who has been hosting volunteers who are down here to help a Democrat in that race.
So, John Ossoff.
Helping John Ossoff. But so she's hosting people to have volunteers who need a place to stay while they're down here helping out. Another friend, and I guess perhaps you could roughly categorize us as what's been called pantsuit nation, but women over 50 who were very much interested in getting Hillary Clinton elected. Another friend who has been making spaghetti suppers to take to volunteers, again, at Ossoff for his campaign. But it still speaks to me of just this is much more than a special election to fill Tom Price's seat. This is the outlet right now for every piece of Democratic anger and upset and angst over what's going on nationally.
And that's why that race is being watched nationally and of course statewide as well, because if Ossoff can get into the runoff, which even Republican candidates are seeing as a given, and you know maybe has a chance at winning the June 20 runoff. We'll see. But if he does, or if he makes it close, then other 2018 campaigns, congressional campaigns, will have to take a cue from it. You know, Republicans might have to moderate their messages. And of course, in Georgia, it could send a message to establishment Republicans of how they run their race for statewide office.
Of course, you know, Kyle, hearing the way Beth just described that, which is pretty interesting. I tell you what it reminds me of. It reminds me of what happened in Georgia in 1992. Bill Clinton won the state, but the Senate race went to a runoff between Paul Coverdale, the challenger, the Republican challenger, and Weitch Fowler, the incumbent Democrat. And there are many people who feel that one of the reasons, aside from the way Weitch Fowler campaigned, which is a whole different
story,
is that backlash— anger among Republicans really mobilized them to turn out in that runoff and defeat a Democrat. I think what Beth just talked about is a very similar dynamic.
Well, in runoffs and special elections, we know that we don't know who's going to show up, right? I mean, how many? And this is, I've actually begun to hear some Republicans concerned that this, all this enthusiasm that Beth's talking about, and this clearly is there, combined with sort of maybe some Republican voter complacence, maybe just some people sitting back and saying, you know, I'm going to wait and see who makes it to the runoff and then I'll make my decision. I don't, you know, there's too many candidates out there. I don't really want to invest this amount of time. The springtime is, if you have children, is a super busy time of year with school and everything. So you could have a situation where Democratic enthusiasm is really high, Republican turnout is meh, and they're worried that you could actually see Ossoff pull off a really big upset in the April contest, the primary, so
to speak. If you're keeping score out there, I want to note that we have slid over, it's perfectly fine with me, to the 6th District Congressional race. So let's keep talking about it. But then I do want to return for just a minute to the governor's race as well. But so let's talk about the 6th District for another minute. There's been a lot of attention, Greg. We know Ossoff's getting big money, or he says
he's in Washington right now for a fundraiser with Nancy Pelosi and House leadership. So,
and there's been a lot of attention paid to the anti-Ossoff ads, which show him in a college video playing Star Wars. Fine. From my point of view, there's something, and I want to get your response, all of you. In a way, I think it's smart, because the one thing that if you're a Democrat supporting John Ossoff, you can talk up is, he's a fresh face. He's young. He's kind of a good-looking guy. He's got a lot going for him in that he is this kind of young, energetic candidate. So why not go after him on those grounds? You know, a guy who behaved in a foolish, silly way in college. But it strikes me that the commercial that really has the potential to sting is the one that's now gone up about his making documentaries for Al Jazeera.
Yeah, I mean, right now you're seeing, as Bill said, a scattershot approach from Republicans trying to see what sticks. And one of the latest arguments they've made is that John Ossoff's documentary investigative filmmaking company has done extensive work with Al Jazeera, which has been accused of being a propaganda outlet for the government of Qatar, and for being anti-Western. And his campaign had a very lengthy statement last night, basically saying that yes, he has done work with Al Jazeera, and here's a list of all the other outlets they've done work for, and that an attack on that is an attack on journalism, and it's a partisan style attack. But that doesn't mean that that attack will not resonate with conservative voters who are likely to vote.
Yeah,
in this
Kyle, I would think in the 6th district, working for Al Jazeera is not something that'll be very well received, even though he has, as Greg points out, worked for any number of other, BBC, among others. He's sold, essentially, documentaries to them as well. But Al Jazeera, it puts a real target on his back.
I think this comes across a lot worse than dressing up as Han Solo.
Exactly, my point.
That first video, I understood the point of trying to get out there from a Republican perspective attacking him. I didn't think very highly of the particular attack that they made. But yeah, I agree with Greg. They're going to try to see what can stick. They want to foreclose that possibility of a shock defeat in April. They want to make sure that their base knows that they need to come out and vote for a Republican. And if they can just keep the numbers the way they're quote-unquote supposed to be in that district, the math takes over at that point. I mean, it's a 60-40 Republican district. There's no reason in an election where you have anything close to typical type of turnout, not the amount, but the proportions, that they should have to sweat this thing. Getting a Democrat in the runoff, yeah, because there's 11 Republicans and 5 Democrats. I mean, you can see how that would work. But I do think you'll continue to see stuff like this to make sure that they get Republicans to show up and vote. They don't vote for whoever. Just make sure that there's enough of them out there that keep him below 50%, and then the runoff shouldn't really be a problem.
I think that that John Ossoff, and I've met him once. I know his mother very well. We're longtime friends. I think that it's, you have to describe him as a phenomenon who's just kind of, he's like a bolt out of the blue that I don't think anybody really expected, Democrats or Republicans. But what that's enabled him to do is to amass a tremendous amount of money, particularly for a first-time candidate and running in a special election, and to amass all the resources that he'll need. And I think that Kyle's numbers are right. It's still hard on paper to see how a Democrat wins that seat. But if you've got all the resources you need to do voter targeting, and you've got volunteers coming in from all over the country to knock on doors and staff the phones and do things like that, then you've got the makings for pulling off an upset. But I think it's another harmonic convergence type of situation.
One other thing he has to his advantage, in my view, is with an 18-person field, I've been approached by some groups that want to do debates or candidate forums, that kind of thing. It looks like I probably will be moderating one for the 6th Congressional District GOP. But even there, they're going to have 3, and they're trying to use polls to determine who should be on the stage. You're never going to see him in a format where he has to be up there against 3 or 4 of the top Republicans all at one time, and they can try to expose some of his inexperience in that way. I mean, he was in a forum with other Democrats, and I think there were some attempts to do that, not particularly successful. Yeah. But what I'm talking about is the kind of things that they would use against him in the context of a district that tends to vote Republican.
Okay.
I think that's where he would be vulnerable, but I don't think there's going to be the opportunity for them to do that.
So, you know, you point out how difficult special elections can be in turnout. And Greg, you know, there's such fragility around this race. For example, we've talked on this show about the fact that with a field that large, 12% could be enough to get you in the runoff. 12% of what may already be a small turnout election, although I would argue there's so much attention focused on it. This may not be a typical special election turnout, but we don't know. And with that same thing in mind, Kyle talked about polling. You know, the only poll that I've seen is this. So Channel 11 tried to poll it. And Karen Handel came out on top of the Republican field, right, in that poll. It seems to me to be really foolish to pay any attention to a poll in a district with 18 candidates. I mean, can you really poll that with any accuracy?
You can't keep the respondent awake long
you
enough.
You know,
to
you're the
entire list of 18 names.
I should have directed that to you.
That's right.
Would you ever even try to poll something like that? I suppose if the money is good.
You know, if the money is good. No, I think it would be very difficult.
Yeah.
I just think polling is challenging enough in a special election to begin with. And then if you got to sit there and read through 18 names.
Yeah.
Your respondents' eyes are glazing over.
And that's what makes this all the more remarkable, too, in that, as Beth was mentioning, I mean, very few people outside of Democratic circles even had heard of Ossoff before this race. After a few higher-profile Democrats said they weren't running, it looked like it was just going to be between a couple of former state legislators who had some support but weren't ever going to have this type of groundswell, this type of national attention that I think John Ossoff is now getting. $3 million in cash, Nancy Pelosi, the DCCC, the DNC, all backing his campaign. And what his Republican rivals, what they marvel at, though, is his ground game, is the get-out-the-vote efforts. His canvassers have now – I live in the 6th District in Dunwoody. His canvassers have now twice come to my neighborhood. The only other candidate that has matched that has been Bob Gray in my neighborhood.
All right. If that's the case, then he better win this thing without a runoff. He better get 50+1% of the vote. Because you're right, Kyle. How does he – once you consolidate the Republicans down to one, I don't know how he could win it.
And I think that's the concern among some of the Republican officials in that district that I talked to. And the fact that they're aware of it probably makes it unlikely that it will happen. I think the sort of perfect storm situation would be kind of across the board complacency on the Republican side, and then this huge enthusiasm on the Democratic side that in that low turnout election threw off the proportions. But I think the fact that we're a month out and they're aware of that and they're running ads against him, I don't think we'll see that. But you know, it's a great thing to be able to to watch as a political observer. And it is the only game in town, not just here in Georgia, but in the whole country, which
yes.
explains a lot of that national attention and money that
he's getting. And also, this is not just any special election. This is Tom Price's seat. Mm-hmm. This is the Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Right.
This is the guy who's one of the faces of Trump Care. And so the Republicans are not going to want to be embarrassed in Tom Price's not just home state, but his seat. So that's why it's just hard to see how the Republican Party will let this one slip away.
All right. We're going to take a break in a second. We again, tweet us at PoliticsGPB. Ted Barfield tweets, all of this talk of magic Democratic unicorn in the Georgia 6th reminds me of way back when conventional wisdom said Carter and Nunn would win in 2014. Well, he's absolutely right about that. Caleb McMichen, who is David Ralston's communications guy, tweets, I'm calling it Bluestein 2018. Do you want to know? Are you in the mood to announce at this point?
I'm thinking about it, but yeah. I have no announcement.
Well, I'm his spokesman. I'll let you know when we're ready.
All right.
Are you going to turn Georgia Bluestein?
Bluestein. Oh,
I'm
go.
For you.
Oh, she really was a consultant.
Yeah, I like it.
All right. We're going to have to take a break. And I want to tell you, you have all beaten me into submission. We laid out briefly who some of the people are we expect to get into the governor's race. We've said it's going to start soon, but we will not come back to that subject. We'll save that for another show. How's that, Greg Bluestein?
Works for me.
All right, good. We do have a lot to talk about. There's a lot of Trump news to talk about, much of which has been responded to by Georgia members of the legislature, the governor, members of the congressional delegation, the health care plan. We have not been on the air since the CBO report came out, and so we have a lot to talk about in terms of response to that. I'm here with Beth Shapiro, Kyle Wingfield, and Greg Bluestein. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It's served you well over the years and can still get you around town, but let's face it, it's just taking up space. Donate it today. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Greg Bluestein and Kyle Wingfield of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Beth Shapiro, a retired Democratic political consultant and corporate pollster as well as a political pollster, join me today. Okay, so shortly after we went off the air on Monday, we talked a lot through the show on Monday about how we expected any minute the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, report on what the new Trump care, Ryan care, call it what you will, health care bill would cost, how it would deal with the uninsured. You've all seen this by now. CBO says as many as 24 million people will lose their insurance. It will cut the deficit by some maybe $337 billion. Now, what's interesting about this, Kyle, and I would really love to start with you, is that the CBO report was bad enough. But the White House's own economic arm, the Office of Management and Budget, they had even worse figures. They showed it as a 26 million loss in numbers for health care.
Well, their explanation is they were just trying to predict what the CBO was going to come up with. I don't know if you buy that explanation or not. That's what they say. But I have to sound a really skeptical note about this 24 million, and it's something I've written about on my blog. I'll have this in the paper tomorrow. But the CBO has a really terrible track record of projecting how many people are going to buy health insurance under Obamacare. Okay, their initial estimate for last year, and they did this three times, was that it'd be more than 20 million people, and it ended up closer to 10.
Well, you call it, you say 10, because these are people not covered by group plans who chose to get into
this is on the exchanges.
To buy it, as opposed to how Medicaid added to that number.
That's right. We're not talking about Medicaid.
Okay, go ahead.
About exchange purchases. Yeah. So they've been off by several million every year that they've done these projections. And we're currently at 10, 11 million people buying on the exchanges. As soon as next year, they say it's going to be up to 18 or 19. So they've been wildly off in the past. But those projections where they've been off are what they base their projection for the Republican plan.
All right.
So they say there's going to be 19, there would have been 19 million buying, but we're going to start subtracting from that instead of subtracting from the 10 or 11 who have been buying. So what my point is that number is inflated by as many as 7 or 8 million there. And then you look at the way they said that Medicaid would be affected. There's 3, 4, 5 million people that they're saying would lose, quote unquote, lose Medicaid coverage by reining back the expansion in states that didn't even expand Medicaid. They say that right there in the report. So I think the actual number is much smaller than 24 million. And look, if you're one of the people who loses your insurance, you don't care whether it's you and 10 million more people or you and 20 million more people. But my point is, I think the problem that the Republicans have to solve with their bill is much different from the way it looks with the CBO report.
Right.
And that's what they should address, not trying to make the CBO give them a better estimate.
Okay. All right. So, Beth Shapiro, the bumper sticker for Democrats is 24 million uninsured in 10 years. The bumper sticker for Republicans, Greg, is just what Kyle said, and
blame
it wraps around the car four times.
What Kyle just said. or blame the CBO.
Right.
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 Which isn't very. Right.
Yeah, I'm not in with Newt Gingrich saying they're corrupt.
No,
by the way.
I understand
that. This is the way they work.
But my point is, from a political
flawed.
Point of view, this was a devastating. You know what, Greg? Paul Ryan, whether you are on his side philosophically or not, whether you agree with his politics or not, I always thought that he was a pretty savvy politician. I thought his response to the CBO report was so tone deaf. I'm excited by this report, he said. This is a great report. I don't see how, if you want to pass this bill, you can keep talking that way.
Yeah, I mean, remember, it was on the ropes before the CBO report. When you had assault from both sides, both parties' flanks, when you had two of Georgia's nine now, I guess, Republican sitting congressmen already saying they couldn't vote for it as is, that's not a very good sign. The CBO report didn't give any of them cover. And then just today, I mean, now you have the Governor Nathan Deal and other state leaders, and he's one of, I think, 15 Republican governors who have now raised concerns about the national plan, saying that he doesn't feel like Georgia and other states that didn't expand Medicaid should be, quote unquote, punished for not doing so. So you're starting to see a lot of pressure from the state level and from the federal level, as well as the advocacy groups that are fighting against it. So this plan is on the ropes, and the CBO didn't do any.
Yeah, you know, and Beth, you have members of our congressional delegation who are saying, let's see if we can't do some tweaking. You have David Perdue, one of the staunchest supporters of President Trump, an early supporter, saying, let's slow things down and look at it. So, you know, it's interesting. Kyle's may be completely correct that CBO didn't calculate this correctly, but the political damage seems to be pretty extensive.
Well, the headline is pretty devastating. And as somebody who actually, my first job out of graduate school was the Georgia Office of Planning and Budget, which is to the Georgia governor what OMB is to the president,
sure,
what CBO is to Congress. I tend to take great offense when people start attacking those particular messengers because they generally are objective analyst of policy. Now, we could disagree with their findings, but I think to do what former Congressman Gingrich did and just, as he sometimes will do, go off the deep end in his criticism of them, I think it's unfair.
He called for the elimination of CBO as a result of this.
You know, at some point we have to agree as Republicans and Democrats that there are some neutral arbiters and presenters of facts, and I think that these budget offices are one of those. I think that the biggest problem with this plan is not Medicaid per se, but what the impact of cutting Medicaid and cutting access to health care for people who couldn't otherwise get it, what the impact that has on real people. What's so ironic about this is that the projections are that the people who will be hurt most by it are rural people, are people who are 50 and above. The 50 to 64 age group is about to be hit with much higher health insurance premiums. And many of these are the people who voted for Donald Trump, which is why I think we're seeing people like Senator Perdue and some other Republicans, particularly the state level here, kind of putting their hands up and going, wait, let's see what this does. The other impact here is on rural hospitals. We've already got rural hospitals in Georgia in a crisis situation, and this is just going to stress them even more. So I think that this Medicaid piece and how we fund healthcare, how we keep low-income people healthy, which I can't understand why that wouldn't want to be, we wouldn't want that as a policy goal anyway, how that gets solved.
Kyle, Democrats are making a lot out of the equation about the formulas, especially as it relates to older Americans. It appears under the plan, it is older Americans who will be hit harder. They'll pay more for their premiums. And what we hear from Republicans on the Senate side is that's an area that they feel they're very vulnerable on and that they ought to address, right?
Well, so I think that really gets to the two biggest flaws here, okay? And when I point out that I think the effect of this bill wouldn't be as large as the estimate is, I don't mean that to suggest that I think this is a good bill.
Right.
Because
I
don't particularly think it's a good bill. I think the first mistake the House made was going ahead and from the House of Representatives negotiating with a Senate parliamentarian, because that's what this bill is all about, is trying to, well, here's what we think we can get through the Senate reconciliation process. I think both pragmatically and also politically, they would have been far better passing a bill that spelled out their entire vision for how health care reform needs to happen in this country and then send it to the Senate. You would have avoided some of this internal fighting, I think, along the way. Send it to the Senate and let them change it into something that they can get passed with 51 votes, because that's what this is all about, is getting it through the reconciliation process, which is this arcane budget process. If you thought my explanation of the insured was bad earlier, let me try to tell you about reconciliation, right? So that's problem number one. And problem number two is by paring down this bill to what they think they can get passed versus, like I said, their broader vision, they're essentially saying, hey, you know what, the free market, we're going to make this a more free market health insurance market in America, and that's going to make everything better. But they have reduced what they're doing so greatly that the free market still has one hand tied behind its back. It's not going to deliver the benefits that they're talking about because it's still remaining very, very unfree from a free enterprise standpoint. So they're negotiating with themselves. They're not presenting a real vision for healthcare reform. And then they're not really even enacting their own principles in a way that would allow that to work itself out in real life.
And Greg, I think that Kyle just said, among other things, something really interesting. They're not abiding by the principles that they have stood for. And that creates a real issue, potentially, between President Trump and the Steve Bannons who are there advising him and the Paul Ryans and Republicans, because this is not a vision. I mean, Trump said everyone will get coverage.
And it will cost less.
And it will cost less. And so now the principles that we think Trump seems to have stood for, to the extent that we ever quite understand what he stands on, are really, he's been great. He's going to be in Nashville tonight campaigning for the bill. We get that. But there's questions as to whether the White House and the Republicans on the House side are really going to be able to come together and work on the same legislation.
Yeah, I mean, they've painted themselves into a corner by saying exactly what Trump said all around the campaign trail, that this bill will be better than Obamacare. It'll insure just as many people. It'll be an improvement. And if you have just one person in every district who is no longer on the health insurance rolls because of this measure, you will see them in commercials in the 2018 campaign cycle from Democrats running against the
Republicans. There's that, but there's also the fact that the most conservative Republicans, the Breitbart Republicans, see this as another entitlement measure because
it's Obamacare 2.0.
It's Obamacare 2.0.
Yeah, and you cannot say we need a freer health insurance market because that will deliver results, and then not actually change enough about the insurance market to deliver that freedom. I mean, it just the bill doesn't do that. And so you're not going to, in fact, arguably the worst thing you can do from a free market perspective, is tout a non-free market solution as going to deliver the benefits of it. It won't deliver, and then the very brand of free enterprise gets damaged that way.
Do you think, and I'll throw this more to Kyle, just because you speak more from the conservative side of the aisle. Do you think that had the Republicans over the past 5 or 6 years actually taken the time to put together a plan and do the negotiating and the discussion through Congress, that they might have come up with a plan that would have met their principles, but also perhaps could have attracted some Democratic support and enabled us to accomplish the goals of the parties?
So I think the problem here is Trump. And the reason I say that is twofold. One, he went around and said all these goals for the plan, which were, I mean, you're not going to cover more people at less money, certainly not from the get-go. So he establishes unrealistic expectations. But also, Congress did work on some alternative plans. But I think there was always an assumption that you're only going to get it's only going to become law with a Republican in the White House. And that person, precisely because it would become known as their signature law, as we're talking about Trump care here, if it had been Bush care, if it were Jeb or, Scott Walker care, they were going to demand to have a say in it. So I think they always thought they would be taking stuff that they had off the shelf and stuff that a president had talked about on the campaign trail in a more detailed fashion, marry the two, turn it into a bill. Gotcha. Instead, they get someone who set the expectations too high without any details to go with it. And now they're left saying, well, here's what we really think would work, but it's not going to deliver what he says, but we're going to say it will, and here it is. And I think that's the real problem.
Let me bring it back to Georgia, although, by the way, to put a period on this part of the conversation, it is not completely unthinkable that there could be, if things don't kind of move more positively, a divorce between the White House and leadership in the Republican Congress over this thing, right? But let me, Greg, Dee Dee Murphy kind of brings us a full circle. She tweets, the repeal and replace threat of ACA will affect the 6th District race. You think that's right?
We are already seeing a little bit of that.
Okay.
I polled about 10 or 11 of the top candidates, because it's hard to get all 18, but I polled 10 or 11 of the top candidates to ask them their thoughts. And they ranged. I mean, the Democrats obviously were against it. But Republicans, several of the leading Republican contenders said that they urged more time, a more cautious approach, a more pragmatic approach to health care. And then several others, including the big Trump supporters in the race, said, nope, it's 100% right. Stay with it. Don't change a word. So we're already seeing some of the effects of that. It hadn't come up. I went to a couple of Republican events over the weekend. It didn't really play up big there. But I think among voters and at town hall meetings and the like, we're going to hear a lot more about that.
Just to, again, bring it back to Georgia, you in Political Insider blog on myajc.com, you all report that Buddy Carter, Representative Carter from Pooler, was going to be down at the Capitol today. He's a big supporter of the bill, right? And he's trying to explain it to members down there, legislators down there.
Yeah, and his visit came, and he was on the House Energy Committee that already voted to pass the bill.
Right.
His visit came on the same day that Governor Deal, for the third or fourth time now, has raised the concerns that this bill could hurt Georgia because Georgia refused to expand Medicaid.
Which is what Governor Deal has been concerned about, that the calculus by which states will get their block grants for Medicaid, which is, by the way, in and of itself a very controversial issue, doing block grants for Medicaid, could very well be based on how much you're already spending on Medicaid. And if you're not taking that federal money, you don't have the same big sums that the states that did take the federal Medicaid money.
Under this plan, it is not out of the realm of possibility that Georgia, after Governor Deal and other Republican leaders have for years said it's too expensive to expand Medicaid, they might have to expand Medicaid by 2020.
All right, I want to take up another issue that's gotten almost no attention, to the best of my knowledge. I saw a report on NBC News about this. Buried in this bill is a provision that would according to NBC News, take $1 billion from CDC from their preventive
disease
care
funding.
And their disease funding. And that's, Beth, been controversial over the years. There have been conservative members of Congress who have fought against the notion that CDC should be in the prevention side of the business. And this bill seems to really be aimed at them, and CDC says it's really going to hurt our work on any number of important diseases like Zika, like bird flu, which is making a comeback of a sort. They talk about yellow fever, of all things. And that may be only the beginning, because there's been talk that, that when Trump presents a budget plan, that will take more money from CDC.
Well, there are obviously major public health implications to reducing funding for preventable diseases. Which is among the many groups opposing this bill is the American Public Health Association, and I would assume it's for that very reason, or among other reasons. But the other implication for Georgia is the economic impact. The Centers for Disease Control is a major employer. It's a major presence in DeKalb County in the state. And if you start to take $12 million, or I think that's the amount out of their budget, you're talking about not just the public health impact, but real people's jobs.
Actually, they're talking about 12% of the CDC
Thank you.
Budget.
Okay, so that's obviously going to be higher, I assume, higher than
yeah, it's close to $1 billion, apparently.
Yeah, so that's a lot of money to take out of Georgia, and to take out of a state that has a growing presence and reputation nationally for healthcare leadership and healthcare prowess.
Just we're going to have to take a break, but just to make clear what they're talking about, it's $931 million for 2017, and this is money that CDC has used for vaccines, for infectious diseases, lead in water, promoting breastfeeding in hospitals, suicide prevention, and hospital-associated infections. Again, Kyle, there are a couple things in there that if you're a conservative really concerned about federal spending, you could challenge. You know, is it the CDC's job to promote breastfeeding, for example? It has preventive value down the road. But I do understand the point that can be made about these specifics. But this is a broad brush approach.
Yeah, and I think the answer would probably come back, look, we're still appropriating a lot of money to this agency. If some of those are their priorities, they can take from
shift,
other areas, shift and deal with those. But you know, this to me, what this gets to is the bigger question of, okay, how do we rein in federal budget deficits? How do we get debt under control? And when you have a president who has taken the biggest drivers of spending, which are our big social programs, off the table, you're left trying to get a nickel and a dime here, you know, relatively speaking, in the context of the entire federal budget, here and there from, you know, programs that you can make all those sorts of cases about that they should keep it. So it again gets to me to the split between this president and the Republicans in Congress as to how they've approached the nation's biggest problems, and I don't see a bridge between those two. However nice they're talking about this health bill and everything, I don't really see a bridge between those two at this point.
I'm going to do my host prerogative to have the last comment before the break. I usually don't do that, but I will. Part of this has to do with the fact that what Republicans in the House right now are really doing is trying to fulfill a longstanding campaign pledge more than trying to truly take their time and come up with a healthcare plan that really, really could be beneficial to the country. I got the last word on that one. It's 2:50 on Wednesday afternoon. We'll take a very short break and come back with more news here on Political Rewind.
Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
On the next Fresh Air, Jordan Peele talks about writing and directing Get Out, his new horror film with racial anxiety at its center. It's about a young African-American man whose white girlfriend takes him to meet her parents in a wealthy white suburb. Peele is also half of the comedy duo Key and Peele. Join us. Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
And itchy fingers.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. That was Beth Shapiro. And she is joining me along with Kyle Wingfield and Greg Bluestein. Greg, the old cliche is elections have consequences. And in Cobb County, which went Democratic for Hillary Clinton in November, that election in Cobb had some consequences. What happened this past weekend?
We saw a Make Cobb Red Again campaign win. Jason Shepard, who ran for the Cobb County chairmanship in 2015 and lost, pretty much flipped the script and beat Rose Wing, the incumbent, by a pretty healthy margin, basically saying that I will make Cobb red again. And he's starting with the 6th district race. And then 2018, Republican, whoever wins runs for governor on the Republican ticket will need healthy support from Cobb County, which hadn't gone blue since Jimmy Carter's era and actually voted against Carter in 1980. So this was totally unexpected. I mean, I think we were sitting in this room thinking maybe Gwinnett, probably Henry County, but no one was talking about Cobb County.
Yeah, so they lost a chairperson lost a job as a result of that election. Kyle Wingfield, Johnny Isaacson wants to quickly assure people he is not a stoner, but he has suggested removing marijuana from a category of the most dangerous addictive drugs. What's that about?
I think I saw a clarification that it's cannabidiol oil specifically. We're not talking about a recreational marijuana that that someone's smoking. He's not talking about that. But there's a lot of pressure. We've talked about this issue in Georgia in the legislature for several years now. There's a lot of back and forth, but a lot of the pushback that you see in the legislature toward going farther on that issue is the feds have to make some changes before any of that really makes sense. You're basically possibly encouraging people to break federal law by passing more of these state laws. And I think that's a genuine concern for a lot of Republicans who might otherwise be willing to push the envelope on the medical marijuana issue more. So I have to imagine he's gotten a lot of pressure because the activists on this issue are very active, and they've contacted their state legislators very frequently for a while, and I think they've finally gotten the message that Congress has to make some changes before this can go farther.
He did correct it. The first item that appeared on the AJC Political Insider blog said he was now going to argue for medical marijuana being removed. And I can only imagine what the response in Johnny's office up there on the Hill was. And they very quickly called you guys up and said, please, it's only... How do you pronounce the oil one more time?
I believe it's cannabidiol oil.
I'm very impressed.
What I hear the most frequently anyway.
I always pronounce it wrong. So thank you. Beth Shapiro. So tonight, Trump goes to Nashville to talk health care. But before he gets there, he's going to be in Ypsilanti, Michigan, where he is going to roll out his response. He's going to cut back on the president's emission standards. He says that they are bad for the country, bad for the auto industry. It's another one of his efforts to deregulate a lot of the environmental laws that were put into place during the Obama administration. And it's a big one.
It should come as no surprise, though, to anybody who followed his campaign and his promises. And it should also come as no surprise that he, A, likes to be out on the road and be in front of crowds who are adoring him. And B, that he's very good at changing the subject. So we've had about 10 different subjects that we could have talked about just over the past 3 or 4 days alone with President Trump.
Well, I would argue that this is not quite the same as tweeting, President Obama tried to tap my phones. I would argue he believes that we need to deregulate.
I agree. He may have different methods for getting us to pay attention to what he wants us to pay attention to and to ignore that which he would for us to ignore.
Right. Well,
but I think that's all of a piece. But I think if you look at what's going to be happening at the EPA and you look at what's going to be happening with what he's announcing tonight, it's of a lot of concern to those of us who believe that climate change is real.
It's real.
And is causing damage to ourselves and to the earth.
Greg Bluestein, last night, Rachel Maddow, who does a show on MSNBC, broke a story that she said was a big story, and everybody's picking it up. Two pages of the president's tax returns from 2004 or 2005, showing that he actually paid a lot of taxes.
Yeah, he paid about, I think it was the 25% rate. And for those of us
higher than
in,
Mitt Romney.
Higher than Mitt Romney. Yep. And for those of us tuning in, we had to kind of wait 30, 40 minutes to see.
You know
see
what?
That.
That's exactly why I brought this up. Rachel Maddow's numbers have skyrocketed since the Trump administration. She beat Bill O'Reilly in terms of that big demographic of younger viewers. But just because we can talk about her, the way she tells her stories is maddening, isn't it? It takes forever to get to the punchline.
Especially last night. I mean, there was one really good tweet that she trolled the nation, basically requiring everyone to tune in. And actually, the White House beat her to the punch.
Yeah,
and
she had tweeted earlier and given her hand away.
I think around 7:30, 7:45, she tweeted that it was coming. Her show doesn't come until 9. No, none of us journalists can believe you sit on a story like that for more than an hour. And the White House beat her to the punch, put out a press release right before the show. And, you know, before her show even aired, New York Times, Politico, a lot of the national media outlets had a story ready.
You know, it strikes me, we got about 30 seconds. And this is a bigger subject. We should talk about it more. It strikes me that the siloing has become so intense that someone who I've always enjoyed watching her show. She seems smart. She's certainly articulate. She writes interesting copy. She is so in the silo against Trump that it creates real problems for dealing with her, listening to her credibility every now and then, because she interprets everything as a plot that Trump has launched. Yeah. You're a fan, I know.
Actually, no, I'm a fan of self-preservation, so I don't watch a lot of cable news. And perhaps I shouldn't admit that being on this show. I listen to Political Rewind because that's where
there
I get the best news. But I just think that there are a lot of people on my side of the aisle who are keeping themselves in a perpetual state of angst and upset. And
yes.
I refuse to be one of those
I think
people.
That's right. Okay.
And so I don't watch her. I do think she's very smart, has a good show, but I don't watch her.
All right. We got to call time out. And I will end by saying just that. I am so gratified with the number of people who tell us that they listen to this show because they feel like we do give you a fairly well-rounded presentation of what's happening politically. I hope that's true. It's certainly something I work for every single show. So thank you, Beth Shapiro, Kyle Wingfield, Greg Bluestein. Pleasure to have you here. This show will be posted on the AJC Political Insider blog sometime in the next little while. You can listen to it there again because it was so good. We're done today. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll see you Friday at 3 o'clock with another Political Rewind.